I would.
Thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started here. Today is November 13, 2017. Call to order the second meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. We're going to open up an informational meeting. We have an overview of the legislative policy and research from the research office. And oh, there he is. And let's see, the Legislative Policy and Research Office, LPRO, provides centralized and professional and nonpartisan research issue and issues analysis and committee management services for the Legislative Assembly. Chris Reinhart is here, Director of Legislative Policy and Research, to provide an overview of the office and its services. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, I'm just take a few minutes of your time. I know you have a busy agenda, but thank you for inviting me to talk a little bit about what we're doing at LPRO and where we're going. As you know, we are transitioning from the former Committee Services Office. We started that transition during last year, and we officially statutorily became LPRO on our own agency this July 1, and we're still moving into this expanded research function that's been assigned to us through the legislation. And we're staffing up to get to full capacity and trying to address as wide a range of needs for the legislature as we can. We have a wide range of people on hand with subject matter expertise and research skills that are available at your disposal, and we're trying to find the best ways to serve you that we can. And I'd just like to provide a few examples of what we can do, what we're doing, and let you know how to contact us and use our services. I've provided a couple of documents for you at our dais that are kind of background briefs that we've prepared that are good examples of the kind of work that we can do to kind of inform your decision making, collect the background research that can help you in the committee's work. One is a background brief on the Oregon workforce system, a general document explaining how the system, you know, who the system serves, all the different agencies involved in the system. We're trying the best we can to use graphical displays, present information in the easiest and most accessible way possible. And we've compiled a list of significant legislation that's affected the workforce system over the last 30 years. So just some general background information to help maybe inform your thoughts about how you might want to work with the system. Some background information so you know where the system has come from and to get to where it is. I think these may be particularly useful to people who are new to the issue coming onto a committee for the first time. We have a collection of 80 to 100 background briefs that cover the wide range of issues, and we're trying to expand that with some more specific ones and some more timely ones. The second one that I handed out today is one that Deborah just completed with information on family and medical leave. She's collected information on the existing federal law, all the existing Oregon laws, family and medical leave, military family leave, all the different aspects of leave that are covered by the current statutes, paid sick leave law. And then she's collected information from other states that have implemented a paid family leave law and proposals under federal law and in other states. And in the end, she's tried to come up with charts that compare the existing Oregon laws and then a lengthier table comparing all the important aspects of the states that have currently adopted a paid family leave law so that you can see the different aspects of those laws and the different conclusions that those other states have made on different policy choices. And these are both documents that are posted on our website, and we continue to post these kind of generic informational pieces on our website for everybody to see. So I think these are two good products that are hopefully would be useful in your work. Other things that you might be able to ask us, if you're exploring a new topic for the first time and you want to collect background information, you know, we can be a source for you for objective, nonpartisan work. We can look to all the different sources and kind of filter it for you to give you the most important things and to let you know the different perspectives that are coming together on an issue. We can try to analyze the effectiveness of an existing program or policy that you have an interest in. We can gather information from the agencies. We can collect data. We can analyze it. We can do a literature review that might give some evidence of what's happening in other states. What are academics saying about a particular problem or a particular issue? and we can look for policy alternatives if you're looking for a solution to a problem. We can survey other state laws, other state proposals. What are people thinking that can present you with some options to choose from? In general, you know, I think we can be a great source of information for collecting things to help you inform your decision making. At this point, it would be great, you know, if there's anything we can do to help you get ready for the short session, if there are things that we can do to provide you research that can help you prepare to have bills drafted or to make decisions on which policy choices you want to put into those, that would be the most important thing that we could do to assist you at this time. So I think that another important thing is that we will work in conjunction with LC, LFO, LRO. We're not going to duplicate the work that they do, but any requests that you have that fall in, you know, multiple categories, we can be working with them. We can do the policy options work that you might ask for, and we can work with LFO to work on the financial parts of that. We can work with LRO on any revenue pieces, and we can work with LC if you're interested in having something drafted. We can collect information that helps you to the extent that the work that you need crosses over boundaries. We're more than happy to work with the other offices and collaborate. And I'd say the one thing that we can't do as a nonpartisan office is produce partisan work. We can't produce a document. If you want to know all the arguments in favor of a position or all the arguments against it, I would view that as a partisan document that wouldn't be appropriate for our office. But we could provide you the reasons for or against a policy. We would do a nonpartisan look at what are people saying about a particular policy option? What are the arguments for it? What are the arguments against it? What does a literature review say? What are the different perspectives on a particular issue? So as long as we can keep it nonpartisan and objective, I think that's an appropriate request for our office. So the last thing I want to touch on very briefly is how you can submit a request to our office. And the first thing I'd like to say is that there should not be any wrong way to get a request to our office. We're here to serve all the members of the Legislative Assembly. We are a nonpartisan office, and we try our best to meet all the requests that come into our office. So if you want to call the office, the front desk, if you want, you know, a particular researcher that has the subject matter knowledge that you're interested in, you can call that person directly. You can contact Deborah. She will either be the person who responds, or she will find the person in my office that's the appropriate one to respond. We also have a space on the intranet. If you look at the member information page that you have on the intranet, there's a middle column that addresses LPRO research, provides a little bit of the information that I've just given you. There's a place to click to immediately send an email to the office that I get. There's also a way to fill in a form. So we've tried to come up with as many ways as possible for you to submit your request to the office, and we will do our best to address them. As we are still staffing up to our fully authorized staffing level, we are managing our capacity issues, and we will always do our best that we can. You know, we will help talk through with you to get precisely the information that you need and the timeline that you need it. And we're willing to work with you as much as we can to get you what you need in the timeline that you need it. But I just ask for your understanding a little bit that we're still in this growing phase, that we're evolving into a larger office with this larger mission. And that's about all I wanted to say. I mean, our goal is really to be the experts for all of you in this process and provide you with the information you need when you need it. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chris. A couple ones. Where is your office? Where is your department? Where are you located?
Well, we're on three different places in the building. We're down to three places. We're on the fourth floor, that's the largest number of us, in 453. We have space on the third floor of the Capitol, and then we have space on our judiciary wing next to the Senate on the third floor.
The other question is, it sounds like you can answer questions if the questions are asked in the right way. By that I mean you don't do partisan, so you said, you know, 10 reasons why this is opposed. But if we ask you the same question but ask for both pros and cons, then you're able to respond. And I guess the thing I would ask is that if I ask a question, but it doesn't quite have the right way to ask it. Can you help me get the right wording for the questions? Will you provide that service too?
Yes. Senator Taylor, Senator Hansel, yes. I don't want the office to say no ever if we can help it. And I think working with the requester to get the information that you need and maintaining our nonpartisanship would certainly something that we would work with you on.
Great.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Great.
And Deborah? This is fantastic. Thank you for doing this. I saw this a little bit before, but I was just, it's very impressive. I think it'd be very useful. So thank you for doing that. All right, so we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting from LPRO, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the implementation of the Oregon State Retirement Plan, also known as Oregon Saves. And so Oregon Saves is a voluntary retirement plan enacted in 2015, launched in July of 2017 for workers to save money through payroll deductions to their own accounts. We're going to go ahead and bring forward for the implementation Lisa Mazina, Salim Norani.
Norani.
Yeah, there we go. And Joyce DeMonin. Good. All right. All right, so who wants to start?
I will start. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Messina, and I am the Director of Oregon Saves, working in the Oregon State Treasury. You asked us to meet with you today to provide an update on the implementation of the Oregon Saves program, and we're pleased to do that. I'm joined this afternoon by small business owner Salim Nurani of the Cork and Bottle Shop in Corvallis, Albany, and Springfield, and also by Joyce DeMonin, who is the Communications Director with AARP here in Oregon, and both will provide some additional perspectives on Oregon Saves, its meaning for small businesses and for Oregonians. So let's start with an overview of the program. So the legislature has recognized for some time that workers in Oregon needed an easy way to save for retirement through their job, since that's one of the most effective places that happens. As many as 1 million workers in Oregon, and that's more than half of our workforce, don't have the option to save for retirement at work. And about 600,000 of those folks work for an employer who doesn't offer any form of retirement plan. We know for most of us, Social Security payments are not going to be enough when it comes time to retire. Many people also have to retire sooner than planned. Saving even a little bit now can make a significant difference for most of us. And studies also show that folks are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if it's available to them at work. So about 1 in 15 will figure it out outside of work, and about 14 in 15, if it's not offered there, will not find that option. So following the recommendations of the Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force in 2014, the legislature passed House Bill 2960, creating the Oregon Retirement Savings Board and directing the board to establish a retirement savings program ready to accept contributions no later than July 1 of 2017. So that's part of our update today. So let's talk a little bit about how the program has come together. So one of the things that's important to know is who in the state of Oregon will Oregon Saves be relevant for and who will it be close to. So from an employer standpoint, if you're an employer in Oregon who doesn't offer a retirement savings plan to your employees, you will be facilitating Oregon Saves. We'll talk a little bit about how that works. If you are 18 and older and working in the state of Oregon, the program will be available to you either on an opt-out basis or on an opt-in basis, depending on whether or not you work for an employer who doesn't offer a plan, who's facilitating, or you're in one of two other circumstances. You might work for an employer who offers a plan but not to you, so about 200,000 of our workers are in that circumstance, or you might work for, you may be self-employed. And by the way, it's easy for us to think, oh, independently wealthy, but the fact is you're more likely you are an independent contractor, and this is something that would be of benefit to you, and we hear that all the time. So a couple of the things that are great about Oregon Saves, it's completely voluntary for the savers. It's simple and a convenient way for workers to save their own money into their own accounts. Oregon Saves is actually very beneficial to small employers who don't need to offer a retirement plan of their own in order to compete with larger employers. And in fact, we hear that from them all the time, that this helps me level the playing field. Oftentimes, employers tell us, in fact, one example of this is Luke Huffstetter, see if I say his name correctly, from Anastasia Salon in Portland, who every single year has looked into putting in place a 401k for his employees. He has about 40 employees in his salon, and every single year gets back quotes that to him feel too expensive and as if he can't do it. So until Oregon Saves came onto the scene, Anastasia Salons were not offering a retirement savings program to their employees. And those folks, actually, I'll just say, have managed amongst them to save more than $14,000 since July. So very powerful and very productive for them. So we mentioned that the program offers the ability for people to put their own money away for retirement. One of the things that is nice about it is it's very portable. So the money goes immediately into an account in your name. Because that account is in your name and not really connected with your employer, if you go from one employer to another, you still have one account into which the same funds go. So very portable from that standpoint. And when folks change jobs, they don't have to worry about where their money is going, et cetera. So employees who work for a facilitating employer will be automatically enrolled with the ability to opt out ahead of time if they don't want to save for retirement through this program. And all the other savers, as I mentioned, will have the ability to opt in. So about 600,000, we think, are in that opt-out group, and about 400,000 are in the opt-in group. So let's just take a little moment to talk about how the program works. You'll recognize so you'll recognize a few things that are familiar to you if you are participating in a retirement savings plan yourself, and I imagine that each of you are. There are some things that are very similar and then some things that are a little bit different. From the standpoint of the concept of auto-enroll, anytime you have an auto-enroll, you need to have some standard choices that are associated with that. And so the program has three simple standard features. So the first one is if you're automatically enrolled, you'll be saving at the 5% rate, escalating to 10. Your standard investment pathway will be the first $1,000 goes into a capital preservation fund, so focused on safety, with savings after that going into a target retirement fund, and that's focused on essentially getting you to your retirement date with an appropriate level of growth, followed by an appropriate level of safety and income. And then, as we mentioned, the account type is an IRA, and the standard account type is actually a Roth IRA. So a couple of things that I'll share with you about this pathway. So more and more as a best practice in the private sector, employers are using auto-enrollment features with their plans to get folks enrolled. It seems to work far better for us as humans if the action we have to take is an action to get out and not an action to get in. And in the private sector, what we see is that more than 90% of folks stay in when they are auto-enrolled in programs. Something else that I'll mention is the savings rate of 5%. There was a lot of debate about whether or not this was the appropriate rate for Oregon savers. What we're finding is that most folks who stay in the program are staying in at this 5% rate. Some are saving more and some are saving less, but the average rate across all is about 4.7%. So most of them are staying in at 5. Also, the standard investment pathway, we gave a lot of thought. The board gave a great deal of thought to this before it was finalized, and we are finding that most folks are staying with this standard pathway as well. Some are making other choices, deciding perhaps to be all in capital preservation. We have a few people that have decided on the other end to be all in the growth fund, but most are staying with that first $1,000 into capital preservation and everything after that into the target retirement fund. So one of the things I'll mention then, if you think about this and you compare it to other retirement funds, what you'll see is it's a very simple, simple design, and that's by intent. And the design was a result of wide range of inputs from stakeholders here in Oregon and experts locally and nationally. And those stakeholders included both employees, employers, those who work with and support them, et cetera, in addition to some experts retained by the board to think through what is the right design and what's the right approach to rolling out something like this that's a bit new in the marketplace. So the process enabled the board to develop an approach that is both simple to use, very easy to understand, something you can explain to anyone on any street corner any day, and easy for the employers as well. So one of the things I want to point out, we talk a little bit about auto enrollment and how that is productive for people. People retain their choice, full choice, right? So if this is not something you want to do, it's very easy to not participate and never have an account established. Or if you start saving through the program and it's not something you want to do anymore, it's very easy for you to stop saving or, in fact, even to close your account and get your money back or transfer your money somewhere else if that's something that you decide to do. So we all talked a little bit about saving more or saving less, changing your investments, and the money is always only the money of the saver who's put it into their account. So just to touch on the investment options associated with the program, again, here you see that like most retirement programs, the Oregon Saves program offers a range of funds from conservative to aggressive. I like to sort of ask the trick question, how many choices do you think there are? People will often say, oh, it looks like three choices. In fact, there are 12 target retirement funds in that series. And so there are 14 different choices available to people. And when people are making a decision about what to use, we also see them sometimes moving up and down that spectrum. And instead of choosing the fund that their age would default them into, picking something that's an earlier retirement date or a later retirement date. So at the heart of the program are, in fact, the target retirement funds, which essentially carry an investor to their retirement date. So typically they will start out being more growth oriented, and over time they will become more conservative and more safety oriented for those savers who are approaching retirement. As we've talked about, the program offers a capital preservation fund for those folks who want to save without, with minimum risk associated with their savings, and then a growth fund, which is invested in an S&P 500 index fund. The funds are managed by State Street Global Advisors, or you may sometimes hear us say SSGA for short. And SSGA was selected by the board as part of a competitive process and with the recommendation of the board's investment consultant. They are one of the top asset managers in the U.S. and globally. And the other thing I'll note, just referenced on the bottom of this slide, so the program is required to be self-sustaining and not to cost the state. So in association with that, the program charges a program administration fee, which covers everything associated with it, which is primarily investment management and program administration, so record keeping, administration of the accounts, et cetera. So, and I'll just mention by rule, the fee can't exceed 1.05% a year, so about a dollar per $100 saved. If you compare that to small retirement plans in the U.S., the average small retirement plan all-in cost ranges somewhere from 1 to as much as 2.5% and sometimes close to 3%, so on the good end of that. So let's take just a moment to talk about the program's experience so far. And here you see some of our pilot employers who've been involved with us since actually May and June of this year. We have some good news to share, which is it's early days, but so far the program's working as intended. So I'll talk just a little bit about the pilots. The first pilot included about 11 employers, and actually it started out as 150 employees, but our employers in this state are growing. And so by now they've actually among them added 20 employees. So it's about 170 employees that you see now. And this was basically organized as a shakeout pilot. We had that question amongst ourselves, should we do a big bang? Or should we go in a little more slowly and make sure that we have a chance to prove the concepts? And so this pilot was intended to prove that money and data would go where they were supposed to go, and that communications from an employer and an employee standpoint would be clear. And so this first set of employers ranged in size from as few as one employee to as many as 40. So you can see they were pretty small. Variety of industries covered, so everybody from a retail chocolatier and a hair salon, as we mentioned, to traffic detection systems and daycare and a few others in between. So really a wide range of different types of employer and employee types. One of the things that we did as part of the rollout is we watched the employers at every step. So we did all of this work on an observed basis, just standing back and looking to see when they go to register online, how intuitive is it? How far can they get before they get stuck? And so through that process, we learned a few good lessons. Nothing can ever be too simple or too obvious. And that gave us a chance to do some tune-ups with regard to things like navigation or even when you communicate with people. Don't go below the line. They're only going to read this much. So it doesn't matter what amazing thing you're going to say. You got to keep it simple. So we made a bunch of enhancements and improvements to the program, and then we rolled out Pilot 2, which actually we're in the process of continuing to roll out even today. So Pilot 2 started in August for October funding, and it was quite a bit bigger by comparison to Pilot 1. So this included more than 40 employers, more than 2,300 employees, and was intended to tackle a wider range of circumstances, so more types of payroll, more diverse locations in terms of employers with multiple locations and more complex circumstances, a broader geography. And a big part of the focus here was on self-service. How easy, if we're talking about a lot of employers in Oregon, how easy will it be for employers to go through this process from end to end without picking up the phone and calling to get some form of support? And in fact, more than half, most of the employers in this pilot were able to do this on their own end to end. A couple of things. So again, you always find things that you could do a little bit better. So every step along the way, we have found a few things. We made a few additional improvements to the process. Some of those were on the large end. So our larger employers here had more than 500 employees. And so they were looking for some of the things that would make it even faster and more efficient for them to upload and include their employee information. A couple of things I want to call out for some of the information that you see or some of the notes that you see here. So Pilot 1, that first group of employees have saved more than $50,000. And we say July 1, but in fact, those payrolls rolled in over the course of July. So it's really about a 3, maybe 4 month period of time that they've been able to sock that amount of money away. And you can see Pilot 2, even though it's just getting started, I think here we show $109,000. In fact, it's more than that on a combined basis today. So what's exciting about this is, again, we're seeing what we thought we would see. And as you see this money accumulate for folks, it's real money for real Oregonians, putting them in a better position than they were earlier this year. We think that's valuable. So in terms of other things we expected to see, about 3 out of 4 employees who are given the opportunity are staying in the program. Most of them are using the standard choices, but some of them are making some different choices that they feel are more suitable and appropriate to them. And about 1 in 4 are opting out, saying it's not for me at this point in time. And we're keeping an eye on the different reasons that they're giving us to understand, what does this mean for Oregonians? How should we think about this program? How should we think about retirement savings? So just a couple more. We shared a couple of comments from some of our early pilot participants. I actually think we surprised them a little bit. Here they are commenting on their experience. My favorite note is the one from Judy at Traffic Detection Systems, who said, wow, that was pretty painless. It was like, okay, good. That's what we were aiming for. So our approach is to continue to engage our employers, our employees, and our savers to make sure that we can understand what's working well for them, what's challenging, where we can make it, again, a little bit easier, a little bit more obvious, and how we can put some practical tools in place that just help increase that savings rate. So we've got one more note. Oh, lots of tapping here. One more note. So we are rolling out in phases over time. So think about that million people who are eligible to participate. What we didn't want to do is open the door and try to let everybody in on one day, because we thought that would be just mighty uncomfortable. So following the pilots, we are rolling out the program by employer size. So starting first with our employers in Oregon that have 100 or more employees. Then in 6 months, we'll include employers with 50 and more, slowly working our way down and taking plenty of time to collect whatever information and feedback is needed along the way to make sure that everything works well for that next batch of employers. And I think with that, I guess I'll just touch briefly on on how it works without getting into too much detail, but as the program is rolling out, the first thing we do is we start with advance notification to employers to let them know, here's what's coming. So, for example, for this wave one, where there is a deadline here in November, we reached out toward the end of July by mail to make sure that even though we had been doing environmental communication through the state's agencies, so the Employment Department, the Department of Revenue, BOLI, Secretary of State, and DCBS, we've been piggybacking on their regular communication to make sure that employers know what's coming, because we can do that for free or almost free. But in addition to that, we used direct outreach to let our Wave 1 employers know, here's what's coming, this is for you, this is what you'll need to do. And then we've been adding some environmental communication to that, which I hope some of you have seen, including some digital and radio to again make sure folks know what's coming. When employers get this communication, they're able to come onto the site and do one of two things. If they already offer a plan, they confirm that they are exempt. It's a very fast and easy process that takes about 3 minutes. If they don't offer a plan, they come on and they prepare to facilitate. And again, that's a pretty quick couple-minute process to get started. The end-to-end process for an employer who will be facilitating takes a little bit less than an hour. So that's the whole thing. After that, what they're doing, the program, is communicating with employees, and what the employers are doing is simply executing the payroll deduction. So pretty simple from an employer standpoint. So after that, really the only employer requirement is keep us posted when you have new employees so we can make them aware of this option and the ability to opt out or stay in the program and then execute the payroll deduction. There's really not more from an employer standpoint, and the program stands ready and does take all sorts of questions from folks with regard to what's going on if they've got a question about the program. So we expect to keep working with employers and employees as we encounter new circumstances. So far, what we're hearing is both from employers and savers, the program's pretty simple and easy to work with, and they feel like they're getting good support. As I mentioned earlier, today we have, as of this morning, about $170,000 that's been saved into the program, again, from that period starting July 1, and over 1,000 people with account balances that they wouldn't have had, I'm very confident, without this program. So what I'd like to do is turn it over to Salim Nirani. First, I'll take your questions, and then we'll turn it over to Salim. Yes.
Thank you. That was very informative. I appreciate that. I just was wondering if you can go back and explain the people that opted out, especially in the first phase that
yes.
you had. Can you give a little more information as to, you know, why or?
Yes. So, Chair Taylor and members of the committee, so when we have opt-outs, part of what we're asking for is what's driving that for you. And there are three larger answers that we get. The very first one from folks is, I can't afford to save right now. So again, for that quarter of the population, about a quarter of them are saying, I can't afford it. About a quarter are saying, I'm covered by an account somewhere else. So, you know, think of that as 5 or 6% of the covered population. The other 94, 95% are not saying they're covered by an account somewhere else. And then we have a big bucket called other, which is too big. So we're changing how we ask that question in order to get better detail
okay.
from folks.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Okay.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is Salim Nirani, a small business owner, a liquor agent, volunteer and executive committee member of AARP Oregon. Excuse me. And Vice Chair of Senior Services Advisory Committee, Cascades West, Council of Governments. Oregon Saves is a great program, not only for a small business owner like myself, but also for a vast majority of workers in Oregon who do not have access to a company-sponsored retirement savings program. I've spent the last 25-plus years operating small businesses in Oregon. While I contribute my retail business success and growth to my 11 employees, I have not been able to provide them with a retirement plan. First and foremost, I couldn't afford the cost of establishing a 401k-style plan for my employees. Financial services firms do not offer affordable products to small employers like me because it is hard for them to be profitable managing small business accounts. I've been a strong supporter of Oregon Saves, a program for people who do not have a retirement savings option at work. Oregon Saves has helped to ease retirement fears I have as an entrepreneur. Like many business owners, I have been concerned about my employees' financial security and retirement. One-third of retirees count on Social Security for 90% or more of their income. And 29% of Americans aged 55 to 64 have no retirement savings at all. Relying on just Social Security for retirement income is not enough. It was not designed to be a complete retirement solution. More than half the people working in America do not have access to either a 401k or some form of saving for retirement. I'm not the only one who thinks state-based private retirement plan like Oregon Saves is a great tool for small businesses. Similar plans have garnered support of small business owners across the country. I'm proud to support Oregon Saves and be part of the pilot rollout because it will help my employees be more successful in saving for retirement and live a life with greater dignity, choice, and worry-free, and truly enjoy the golden years of retirement. I thank you for the opportunity and being able to share my thoughts with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Did you say, thank you, Madam Chair, did you say how many employees you have?
I have 11 employees currently, and as we are ramping up for the holiday season, like I mentioned, I'm a liquor agent, so we are a very popular spot. So we'll be ramping up to about 20.
So you have 11 employees?
11 currently.
And how many, did any opt out?
We had two opt out, and both of them, one is already retired. Is collecting Social Security and still has to work because they didn't save enough. And the other one is getting pretty close to retirement.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to congratulate you on your awesome new location.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Joyce Tamanen from AARP, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. I'm really excited to be here today to share with you what we feel is a phenomenal success that the legislature created in 2015, which is the Oregon Saves program. You know, at AARP, we've been very concerned about the retirement security crisis in our country, and I don't know if you saw the recent KGW series on the homeless, but they found out 20% of the homeless are older adults, and many of them are native Portlanders who just got priced out of their community. And because we have such a low retirement savings rate in our state, it's having this ripple effect across our state. So, you know, this has been a big concern for AARP. We don't want to see people entering retirement years in poverty, and we are really afraid that that was a big concern. So we supported legislation in 2013 and 2015 that ultimately created the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. So, you know, we're very proud that Oregon is the first in the nation to create this bold step. Other states are looking at us and following closely behind. And I can tell you everything that we do here, everyone's writing down and copying in many other states. So we'll be a role model across the United States. So I would just want to say that Oregon, AARP Oregon, is fully supportive of what is happening at Treasury, and that our retirement experts and policy experts are beyond thrilled by the success of the program. I think it's met and maybe exceeded people's expectations. We had a policy forum in October with a couple of the fathers of the auto IRA, and I asked one of them, David John, who now works for AARP, who created this idea at the Heritage Institute, by the way, said, how are you feeling about this? And he goes, you know, I'm feeling very emotional because they tried to get this done at the federal level, and because of the lack of bipartisanship at the federal level, they weren't able to do this. So it's really a great thing that the legislature has done here. So we are at AARP committed to continuing helping the Treasury Department and Oregon Saves in any way we can. For example, this year AARP launched a rather broad public awareness campaign to let people know this is coming, to better understand retirement tools. But we also know that just educating people isn't enough. There's a ton of financial education out there, But what works is automatic enrollment and paycheck deduction. That is the golden ticket to retirement savings. So I want to just close by letting you know that AARP also conducted some retirement research this summer with DHM. And this idea and this program is very popular in Oregon among both Democrats and Republican. More than 80% of Oregonians like it. So kudos to all of you. And we really believe that this program has the opportunity to really change things in the state of Oregon. Hopefully in 15, 20 years, the idea that we have seniors sleeping on the sleep at the street because they couldn't save for retirement at work will be a thing of the past. And it's a great opportunity to for people to save their own money at work. So thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes. This is probably for Lisa. If we have a person who moves out of state after 5 or 10 years of working in Oregon, what happens to that money? That's question number one. Then I have a question number two.
Okay. Do one at a time. So Chair Taylor and Senator Monis Anderson, I think one of the great things about an IRA account is because it's not connected with a specific employer, it doesn't matter where you go. So if you leave the state, you are able to continue contributing to the account if you like to, continue growing for retirement. If it turns out that you return to the state and you're with a facilitating employer in the future, you'll be able to continue to contribute on a payroll deduction basis. So yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
And then the second question is, after they've been in the system for 10 or 20 years and they want to borrow against it, will there be that option? I don't even know if you can borrow against your own Roth IRA.
Right.
And then pay it back by actually paying interest, but you're paying yourself interest because you're...
Right. So, Chair Taylor and Senator Monis Anderson, from an IRA, you're actually not able to borrow. So you can take a withdrawal, which is more permanent, but you're not actually able to borrow.
Okay.
One of the things we did think about when we were looking at traditional IRA or a Roth IRA is with a Roth, you can at least, if you get into a situation where you need that money, you can take it out without paying a penalty on any of the money you've contributed. And that seemed to be an important thing with this population.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hensel. A couple of great questions for Lisa. I think I saw a slide that the program is funded, the state funds it with a $1 per $100 of revenue. Did I see that slide correctly?
So, Chair Taylor and Senator Hensel, slightly different. The program is funded by participant payment. So savers in the program actually pay that 1%. On an annual basis. In addition to that, there has been some formal funding in the form of a loan, general fund loan, from the legislature to the program to help with startup expenditures.
Okay. So. What, if any, liability does the state have in this program?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. So the state does serve as an investment fiduciary to the program, but I think what the state has done is it's worked with its board to make sure that a very thoughtful program has been crafted that is operating based on best practices that are available today.
So what's the answer to my question?
Well, I'm not sure if I could sum up liability quite as elegantly as that, but I'll just say that the board has worked very hard to make sure that the program is very well organized and has had the appropriate level of legal review for all of the activities that the state is doing and that it's operating in a very careful, very thoughtful way.
Great. Paul?
Yes.
One other is when I saw that slide on the return, you know, on investment and type of thing, are those, you may have said it and I just missed it, but are those goals or are those guaranteed? I mean, where is this?
Yeah, so Chair Taylor and Senator Hensel, so when you saw the investment funds, I think that's what you're referring to, the names that you saw associated with those are essentially objectives. So there's an objective of capital preservation, an objective of growth,
And then in addition to that, objectives associated with different timelines toward retirement.
Okay, but they're objectives and goals.
Not correct.
We as a committee have listened to great length on the you know, PERS guarantees, and just want to make sure we're not embarking inadvertently down the same road.
Well,
it doesn't sound like we are, though.
I think I might be able to set your mind at ease in that somewhat, in that the program is not allowed to offer any guarantees.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so Senator Hansel, did you want Deborah here to look into that one question about the liability and get back to you, or?
Sure, that'd be fine. It sounds like it's pretty low, though,
yeah,
because
I just wanted to make sure that your question was answered if you wanted to. Okay, all right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. So we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting on the Oregon State Retirement Plan, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon State Retirement Plan and the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, otherwise known as ERISA. We are having fun here, folks. This is really a good time. All right, so there has been some question about whether the Oregon SAVES program subjects employers to ERISA requirements. This topic was discussed when the legislation was originally debated and was part of the Oregon Retirement Saving Board's feasibility analysis. I'm going to bring up Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network, which is part of the Oregon Treasury, to provide more information about that issue and answer any questions the committee may have. Although I was making a joke, this is actually a serious topic, and I know you have some information for us here today. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Michael Parker, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network, where recently Oregon SAVES has come under my purview. And yes, today I'm going to be your resident ERISA expert. The reason there's not a DOJ attorney sitting here is DOJ doesn't have ERISA experts at its disposal. So I'm just going to provide a quick update on how we worked through the ERISA issues with Retirement SAVES and hopefully put to bed some of the questions around, you know, what's the issues around ERISA? Are there really issues around ERISA? So please stop me if you have questions as we go through. But during the 2015 legislative session, there was a great deal of discussion about ERISA. No one wanted to preempt, you know, the ERISA issue here, and the legislation had to be crafted to ensure the state was safely on the outside of the ERISA preemption and maintained its safe harbor. So I really wanted to give you the safe harbor conditions. I think that's important under the Department of Labor. So there's four conditions regarding the safe harbor under ERISA where plans can be offered and have that safe harbor of not being under ERISA. All right. So one, there's no contributions by the employer. Two, the sole employer involvement is collecting contributions through payroll deduction and remitting them to the IRA sponsor without employer endorsement of the plan. So an employer can't say, you really should invest in this, it's the greatest thing ever, and if you do it, I will keep your employment. Employers can offer the plan, they can talk about it, but they can't say, make it part of your employment. Three, employer receives no compensation. And then lastly, the employee involvement is completely voluntary. So if the state is meeting those four requirements, which we are not then subject to ERISA, and we are not preempted by the ERISA issues. The Oregon Savings Board was keenly aware of the ERISA preemption issue and early on hired ERISA attorneys, again, DOJ doesn't have them on staff, to provide guidance and advice to ensure the state was in compliance with the safe harbor provisions and all current federal law. The admin rules have been carefully structured to limit the impact on employers. That was a key function as well. Lisa talked a lot about how it's fairly easy. It takes about an hour for an employer to do this. Very easy to get started, very easy to maintain the program. So very, very limited impact on employers. And that means all employers, whether you have a plan currently or you don't have a plan. As Lisa talked about, if you need to exempt out that you have a plan, it takes about 3 minutes to exempt out if you have a current plan, whether it's an ERISA plan or whether it's a non-ERISA-based plan. And as you know, this is a voluntary savings program of which employers can take advantage. There is no requirement for employees to do this. That's the voluntary issue. And I want to stress that employers are absolutely not plan sponsors. They are not offering this program. The state offers the program. employers simply facilitate the program for the benefit of its employees to exercise that option to save for retirement. So we're the plan sponsor, the state. It's a legislative issue. We offer the plan as the state of Oregon, and employers just simply facilitate the program. The only requirement for employers that already provide a retirement plan to their employees, either through ERISA or outside of ERISA, is to certify to the state that they are exempt from providing this plan because they already have a plan either through ERISA or not. This requirement can easily and quickly be satisfied online in about 3 minutes. So it's very simple for employers to say, got a plan, go online, tell us you have a plan. And the reason that that's probably important is because we don't want to spend our time or resources on employers who already have a plan. We want to spend our resources on folks who really are going to use the program. So having them exempt out is important because we want to focus our resources on folks that have the need for the plan. So that's kind of the ERISA update. Again, happy to take any questions that you guys might have.
Okay. Yes. Senator Knopf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, you mentioned that there's that kind of that four-way test. So if any of those four are not true in the future, what happens to the state plan?
Chair Taylor, Senator Knopf, I believe if one of the four is not met or comes out of compliance, then the plan would be out of compliance with ERISA exemption. So the state has to maintain those four provisions at all times. If it comes out of those, then all of a sudden we are now then not preempted then by ERISA at that point.
So follow up. Yeah. So let's say, Michael, let's say in the future that the legislature decides that if they want to either make it mandatory for employees or they want employers to contribute, which takes it out of compliance. Then what would happen to the plan as it relates to ERISA?
Senator Taylor, Senator Knopf, I believe at that point in time, because the law states that if we were to come out of compliance with federal law, that the program would have to reevaluate and either shut down and return contributions, we couldn't keep operating in the same fashion. So if we came out of compliance, essentially the plan would stop and we would evaluate what our options were at that point. Again, I'm not an ERISA attorney, but coming out of compliance means we stop and we reevaluate.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much
for doing that. We're going to go ahead and close the informational meeting on the Oregon State Retirement Plan and ERISA. And now we are going to move on to open an informational meeting on paid family and medical leave. The committee received background on the issue of paid family and medical leave in the September meeting. Also, during the 2017 session, we had one informational meeting on this subject. Today, we have testimony from individuals who will address the need for paid family leave by employees and the issues a company may consider when establishing a paid family leave program. So we are going to go ahead and we're going to bring up all three at the same time? Yeah. Okay. We'll have Jennifer Bevacqua. Come up, perfect. Sorry, I hope I didn't say your name incorrectly. Feel free to correct me when you come up, though. Julia Goodman and Sarah Donitis, please. Oh, Donitis. Dang it.
Almost.
You try and you try and you still make a mistake. Welcome. Okay, who would like to go first?
Go ahead.
Remember to state your name. Of course, you will say it correctly for the record.
Well, now. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. I am Jennifer or Jenny Bevacqua.
Sorry. Okay. Bevacqua.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. So, good afternoon. I'm a registered nurse and a pediatric nurse practitioner here today to testify in favor of paid family and medical leave. My 18 years as a registered nurse and then a nurse practitioner are all in the field of pediatrics. Most of my work experience has been in the two large children's hospitals in Portland, but I'm now also teaching part-time at OHSU in the School of Nursing and working in a clinic part-time. In addition to this work, I'm also a mother to two sons, aged 8 and 10 years of age, a wife, and a daughter of an aging parent. As I see it from the vantage point of caring for sick and injured children over my career, our society does not adequately support families in caring for one another. This is especially disappointing when it comes to children because they are a vulnerable population and they are our future. In my career, I've seen multiple effects of this lack of financially supported family medical leave. I'm going to discuss four types of effects I've seen on the front lines of pediatrics to illustrate why I've come to this conclusion. The first effect I've noted related to the lack of financially supported family medical leave is unnecessary hospitalizations. For example, infants and children who, quote, fail to thrive, end quote. This is a formal diagnosis, abbreviated FTT in the medical literature, and it refers to children who are not gaining weight well. The majority of cases are secondary to inadequate dietary intake, usually related to psychosocial factors or a disturbance in feeding behavior. Overwhelmed caregivers, such as those working long hours and then coming home exhausted and unable to provide adequate care for their infant or young child, constitute such a psychosocial factor. And there's some citations here. Additionally, it is not uncommon for parents to delay seeking medical care for their sick child because of an inability to take off work. In addition to spreading infections, this results in children being even sicker when they do finally seek care. Thus, they are at higher risk for hospitalizations. Asthma exacerbations are a common example of this type of scenario. A day or two delay in treating a mounting asthma attack can lead to serious problems, including suffering of the child, longer treatment courses, an increased risk of hospitalization, and the need for a longer recovery period. A second effect of the lack of financially supported medical leave that I've seen is that inadequate recovery period for children. The parents' needs to rush back to work, if they have had the luxury of time off during the acute phase of illness or injury, can necessitate that the child return to daycare, preschool, or school sooner than is optimal for them. In turn, this has the potential to deleteriously affect their health, and in the case of older children, their school performance. A third effect of this lack of financially supported family medical leave is an increased utilization of urgent care and emergency departments. When parents cannot get time off from work in typical daytime working hours, they are relegated to seek care for their sick child in urgent care or in emergency departments because most clinics close around 5 p.m. It is well documented that parents seek non-emergent care, such as for sore throats or ear pain, inappropriately in emergency departments because they cannot get off work during typical clinic hours. This contributes to increased health care costs to individuals as well as to society, since emergency department care is so much more expensive than clinic care. Moreover, while urgent care and emergency departments provide valuable services, using them frequently as a crutch because you cannot get your child to a regular clinic has its downsides. There is a lack of continuity of care, also called fragmented care, which can ultimately fail to serve the patient's collective needs. I've seen children fall through the cracks many times in this scenario. The national healthcare complex is working hard to develop integrated services to avoid fragmented care. But what would help even more is if we, as a society, better recognized and supported the interdependence of our social services with our health services. Looking upstream a bit further, we can see that financially supported family medical leave ultimately gives us safe space to take care of children and each other in an optimal way and not have to as frequently seek urgent care or emergency department care. A fourth effect of this lack of financially supported family medical leave is emotional distress of hospitalized children. This may surprise you, but it is common for hospitalized children to be unattended by their parents in the hospital because the parents must return to work, or they risk being fired or otherwise risk economic insecurities. Any day of the week, you can walk through Dornbecker or Randall Children's Hospitals in Portland and find young children alone in their hospital rooms. RNs are generally not able to sit with the child because they have multiple patients to care for per shift. This results in emotional distress for children that we have become numb to, relegating it as just the way things are. In the case of older infants and toddlers, we have to use what we and the nurses and doctors call toddler cages to prevent them from falling out of their crib when left unattended. A toddler cage is like a regular crib, but with a top on it, which turns it into a cage essentially, which is why we call it that. A picture of a common toddler cage used in pediatric hospitals is attached to my written testimony. If parents were able to stay with their hospitalized child, use of these common cages would not be necessary. This summarizes some of the effects from the front lines of pediatrics that I have seen resulting from a lack of financially supported family medical leave. Paid family and medical leave programs will benefit children and families through improved economic security and improved health outcomes. By helping individuals and families, society will benefit too, such as through decreased emergency department utilization costs. A rising tide lifts all boats, you see. I hope you will all join me in supporting this legislation and bringing Oregon one step closer to the healthy society our children deserve.
Okay, thank you very much. If anyone has questions, let me know now, or we can wait till the end.
Hi, my name is Julia Goodman, and I am a faculty member of Health Systems Management and Policy at the OHSU and PSU School of Public Health. My PhD training is in health policy, and my research concerns the health impacts of paid family medical leave policies. The health benefits of paid family leave programs for parents and their children have been very well documented. Parental leave policies have been associated with increased breastfeeding, decreased infant mortality, increased immunization rates and well baby visits, and improved maternal mental health. Recent studies have started to uncover a relationship between paid leave policies and improvements in birth outcomes like low birth weight. And this is likely due to an increase of ability of moms in very strenuous jobs to take leave before delivery. In my own research, I found that women in states without any paid leave policies were significantly more likely to work right up until the time their baby was due. In contrast with women in states with paid leave policies who stopped working on average about 2 weeks earlier. There's mounting evidence that these benefits extend well beyond infancy. A study just published this fall found that California's paid family leave program, which was implemented in 2004, reduced the likelihood of overweight, ADHD, hearing problems, and frequent ear infections among elementary school age children, with these results primarily driven by benefits accrued to children from disadvantaged backgrounds. While the benefits to leave taken in the early developmental stages carry forward into later life, the need for paid leave also extends well beyond these early years. In a series of studies on parents of children with special health care needs, parents who took leave from work to care for their ill children reported positive effects on their children's physical and emotional health. But they also reported that staying home strained their finances, and this was especially true when the leave was unpaid. It's not just parents who need paid leave. Increasingly, employed workers are caring for aging or disabled family members. There are an estimated 65.7 million unpaid family caregivers in the U.S., and approximately two-thirds of older adults with disabilities received all their care and assistance from family. The majority of family caregivers are also employed, leading to intense struggles between work and caregiving responsibilities. For this reason, the AARP has recommended expanding opportunities for paid leave to care for ill family members. Importantly, these benefits are primarily seen with paid leave policies. Studies of unpaid leave policies, like the Family and Medical Leave Act, have either found little positive impact on health or benefits that only to those who are relatively advantaged and who can afford to take a period of unpaid leave. Offering some income replacement during leave appears to enable less advantaged individuals to take leave and also increases the participation of fathers. California's paid family leave program doubled maternity leave utilization from about 3 to 6 weeks on average, with leave taking expanding more among non-college educated, unmarried, and minority mothers. That law also increased the share of fathers on leave by 46%. The long-run benefits of paid leave policies are widespread. The U.S. has low female labor force participation, and this has been tied to a lack of family-friendly workplace policies. Paid leave policies are associated with a greater likelihood that mothers have returned to work 9 to 12 weeks after birth, and this is most likely because some of the women who would have quit before delivery decided to stay on. So clearly, paid leave policies are good for employees, but what about the impact on employers? Several surveys of employers in states with paid leave policies, like California and Rhode Island, have shown that the vast majority of employers support paid leave policies and report that they are minimally affected by these laws. In most of these cases, leave is paid for through payroll taxes, so the employers aren't bearing the financial burden of paying for the leave itself. But even in San Francisco, where a new city ordinance requires employers to provide compensation for employees who are out on leave, employers report that providing paid leave is feasible. In in-depth interviews we conducted with covered firms in San Francisco, employers told us they supported these policies, reporting that paid leave was an important benefit for their employees and that having a policy in place helped to level the playing field among employers. The concerns we heard from employers, as well as from stakeholders who were involved in implementing that ordinance, all derive from the piecemeal nature of the existing policies. For example, that there are separate laws for job protection and income replacement. The research in this area strongly suggests that when workers have access to family leave, and especially to paid leave, they're actually able to take the time they need to bond with their children and to care for themselves and their families. So I just wanted to close with a quote from a study that we're doing right now in the Portland metro area that's looking at paid parental leave policies. And we had a focus group with an employee who's a mom of a 5-month-old baby and just returned from paid leave recently, shared with us. And we thought that this perfectly summed up the critical importance of the financial, of providing some financial support to employees who are out on leave. And she said, just because I'm out on leave, it doesn't mean my bills take a break. So thank you. I'll take your questions.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Jonitas, and I am the Director of Social Responsibility at New Seasons Market. Thank you for inviting my testimony today as an OBI board member. I'm happy to speak to New Seasons' support of paid family medical and family leave. New Seasons was founded on the idea that business can be a force for good, serving our staff, our communities, and our planet as part of growing a healthy business. We opened our first store 17 years ago, and today we have 17 stores in Oregon, over 3,000 employees, and we are one of the state's largest private employers. And I think most of you know, some of you know, New Seasons and what we stand for. When people talk about New Seasons, they generally talk about our people. So it might be Corey, who works at our Seven Corners store, who's always ready to share details about the latest arrival in our cheese department, or Ben, who works over at our Cedar Hills store, who can tell you how to roast a perfect chicken, or Amy at our Grant Park store, who has always something delicious to tempt you with at our solutions counter. Clearly, our staff are at the center of our success, and they are the heart of our competitive advantage. We have a dedicated, tenured, engaged staff that feel a strong sense of connection to what we do and how we do it. And they are empowered to deliver an outstanding customer experience, doing whatever it takes to build lasting relationships with our customers. This creates strong customer loyalty, which in turn feeds our success. So it's important to us that we support them with good pay and benefits, predictive scheduling, and advocacy for public policies that ensure our employees, their families, and our communities can thrive. 2 years ago, we came to the Capitol for the first time to advocate on behalf of Oregon workers, asking this legislative body to increase the statewide minimum wage. In this most recent session, we came back to Salem to advocate for funding and policy to ensure that all Oregonians have a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. Today, I'm here to speak about why we support paid family and medical leave and to share the family leave benefit that we at New Seasons as an employer are considering offering our staff. But first, I'd like to share with you excerpts from a letter that we received from one of our staff members shortly after the birth of her first child. I hope this finds you well. I am writing you about 2.5 weeks after my sweet little baby Desmond was born. I was fortunate to have a smooth labor at home with no complications, and I want to start by thanking you, New Seasons, for creating an insurance plan that allowed me to choose this way of bringing my son into the world with zero out-of-pocket costs. My naturopathic midwife is in network, and I get to continue to work with her as my pediatrician, which is really special. Now to the harder part. I'm writing because I think it's important for you to know that the $130 short-term disability checks, which is $200 minus $70 in taxes, that I will receive for only 4 weeks postpartum create a situation of financial stress and insecurity in a very vulnerable time for me. In addition to the pressures of being a new parent to an infant, I need to think about how to pay rent and basic expenses in Portland, where I regularly live paycheck to paycheck. I am one of the fortunate ones that earn over $15 an hour, and this allows me to live close to where I work, buy myself healthy groceries, pay car insurance on an old Subaru, along with my student loans, and live a simple, beautiful life. Unfortunately, it doesn't allow me to save much each month, and I had some complications in pregnancy, which meant I needed an unpaid intermittent leave that ate up the majority of my paid time off. I love working for New Seasons. I represent New Seasons in the community at events. I go to job fairs and lead meet and greets where I share about why this is a great place to work. I regularly go beyond my job description to live our values, and yet I find myself in a position of feeling devalued right now. The amazing individuals that I work with threw me a baby shower and pitched in on a New Seasons gift certificate to help with groceries on my leave, and others have brought me food and diapers. I am amazed by the support and generosity of my community, and I believe it's time for my employer to do its part in supporting this fragile and important life event by providing paid family leave. I know that we work in an industry with tight labor and tighter margins, but if we are going to continue to be a socially responsible business that lives its commitment to taking care of its employees, then we need to stop treating new parenthood as a pathology paid out by an insurance company. New Seasons Market needs to provide paid family leave to all parents along the gender spectrum. It's a pretty powerful letter. And it's a simple truth that we all do need to time to care for our families, whether it's the birth of a child, a serious illness for a spouse, or the end of life for a parent. And taking time off shouldn't mean losing wages or compromising our economic security. There's a moral imperative for supporting paid family and medical leave. And at the same time, we believe there's also a significant business imperative. We know that when you support employees in their personal lives, you create an environment of trust and dedication that pays dividends in terms of loyalty, engagement, and reduced turnover. We want our employees to return to work, ready to work. And as I'm sure you've heard before and will hear again, only 14% of workers in this country have access to paid family and medical leave. And that's not really surprising because for most businesses, including ours, the cost of a robust paid leave program are more than we can afford. However, a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance program could guarantee that every Oregonian can care for their families without compromising their economic security. It would help women overcome barriers to staying in the workforce, support the health of babies and children, and provide statewide benefits like reduced government spending on public assistance. The result for businesses like ours would be healthier and more financially stable communities, more productive employees, and more predictable costs. Now, there are a few simple principles that we believe are important to creating the right policy for Oregonians, individuals, and businesses alike. And the first is that we really believe the program must be universal. All employees should have an opportunity to participate regardless of the size of business they work for or if they are self-employed. We see this as a critical equity principle. Second, we believe every type of family should be covered. We fully support the blood and affinity standard that recognizes the diverse family structures that we have and exist today. Third, it should be simple for businesses and employers to administer. We really can't stress this point enough. Under the current proposal, the employer would not be involved in verifying medical necessity, nor would they have to decide what amount of leave an employee needs, nor would they have to pay them during that leave. For a large company like ours, administering complicated workplace laws is challenging, but it's doable. But for small businesses, it can be crippling. Finally, any new law should be phased and staged so that businesses can gear up for implementation and prepare in advance for the associated costs. We truly believe that a statewide policy is necessary to create a level playing field for Oregon workers. Individuals shouldn't have to win the employer lottery to get the benefits that they deserve. At the same time, we at New Seasons have always believed that we need to take care of our own house first before advocating for others to take action. So we spent quite a bit of time over the last year thinking about what we want to be able to offer our staff in terms of a family leave benefit, what feels like the right thing to do, and what we feel like we can afford. And as context, I would share with you that over the years, we've worked very hard to build a culture and a workplace that is supportive of families. And that includes being very generous in terms of leaves of absence. But that's very different than paid leave. As you heard mentioned in the staff letter that I read, we currently do offer a paid short-term disability benefit, but it only provides $200 per week for 4 weeks of medical leave. That's not enough for most folks to pay their bills. And as we've modeled costs of different benefit alternatives, it's become clear to us that we can't afford a comprehensive paid family and medical leave benefit program all by ourselves. When we thought about what was most important to us, what we wanted to prioritize, we all agreed that we wanted to be able to support our staff members when they're welcoming a new family member. Whether it be a birth, an adoption, or a long-term legal guardianship, we believe everyone should have at least 4 weeks to bond with a new family member, at a minimum. And we want our staff to be made financially whole during that time. So we're in the process of writing a new policy for 2018 that will be available to our benefits eligible staff. For us, that's 24 hours or more, that would provide 4 weeks of bonding leave fully paid for staff members. There are certainly many challenges that we face in designing and implementing a benefit like this. The cost, of course, is a consideration. Every year, like all businesses, we're faced with the challenge of trying to balance the rising costs of healthcare with our desire to provide a truly robust and competitive compensation and benefits program. We weigh the pros and cons of shifting plan design to limit total costs and how much of the cost we feel we can and should pass on to employees versus what we should absorb ourselves. There's always trade-offs to consider. Layering in an additional benefit generally means something else has to give. Coordinating a paid leave benefit with federal and state laws is also inherently complicated. New Seasons right now is a regional company. We have two banners across three states. We're in Oregon, Washington, and in Northern California. Each of these states has their own protected leave policies that integrate with the federal leave protections, and Washington and California have different paid leave policies as well. So it can be quite complicated. The final challenge for us is to think about what we want to offer now, knowing that we would need to make changes if a paid family and medical leave program was put into place in Oregon, which we hope it is. Our thinking at the moment is that we would shift our internal benefit to pay the difference between what a state program would pay for that bonding period and the employee's normal earnings, the difference essentially that it would make to take them whole. That will be a complicated solution for us, but we welcome the challenge because we believe that it's time for all Oregonians to be able to take care of themselves and their families without compromising economic security. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share our company's views on why paid family and medical leave is so critical to the health and well-being of our employees and the state's economy. I'm very happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Sarah. I just have a quick question. I think what I'm hearing you saying is we really want to have a policy like that. We as a company can't afford it. Mm-hmm. What makes you think the state can afford it?
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, I think by having a statewide insurance program that is a combination of contributions from employers and employees across the state can create something that is financially stable and viable for the entire state versus an individual employer fronting all of the costs.
Senator Knopf?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Sarah, what you mentioned that there are trade-offs. Have you at New Seasons made any trade-offs in order to, or are going to be making any trade-offs in terms of benefits or salary increases or, and such to bring forward your four-week bonding leave policy?
Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, thank you for your question. At this juncture, no, we haven't. We've determined based on this plan design how much we think it's going to cost. And at this juncture, we would look to other areas within our business to try to pull from. We don't feel at this point that we want to take away anything we have from a benefits perspective. And we've already made decisions, and which we've announced to our staff around wage increases for next year. So we would likely look to places like waste within our business, productivity that we would try to tighten up a little bit in order to be able to offer this benefit.
Follow up?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Obviously there's going to be a benefit to the employees, mm-hmm. but can you share what you think your cost is going to be, like per employee or per month or an annual basis, mm-hmm. for the program that you're trying to institute?
As a private company, we generally don't share that type of information publicly. I'd be happy to speak to you offline if you'd like to about that.
Thank you.
Rather not have it on the record.
Yep.
Okay. Any other questions? So I have a few questions. So regarding the scheduling aspect of this, one of the things mm-hmm. that we've been hearing about is what to do when, let's say, somebody's taking care of, use the classic example, someone has a sick mother and mm-hmm.
maybe you need to take one day a week off or something like that, mm-hmm. or it's not necessarily just leave for a month or something like that. Mm-hmm. So how, because your stores are open for, obviously you're early in the morning to late at night, and or not super late at night, but, you know, then how are you going to accommodate for that? Are you, with the scheduling, et cetera, how will that work for retail?
Thank you for your question, Chair Taylor. We already have folks that take intermittent leave from a protected standpoint, unpaid leave. Plus, realistically, as a retail operation with 3,000 employees, you have lots of folks that are calling in sick every day. So we're used to having to flex our schedule and to schedule accordingly for folks. So I don't know that that would create any new issue for us. It's basically how we're accustomed to running the business.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's great. sounds like obviously you've had time to look up the bill that we have now, and
yes.
There could very well be changes to the bill. But is there mm-hmm. anything else in the bill that is of concern to you that you can think of off the top of your head, or you don't have to answer right now? But
thank you, Chair Taylor. I think the only concern, as written right now, the proposal, as I understand it, seems very simple to administer. And I guess my only concern, or our only concern, would be if that gets complicated over time, if changes are made that make that administrative piece more onerous for businesses, because between protected sick time, Portland paid sick time, leaves, OFLA, FEMLA, there's a lot of administration already that we're required to do. So just the simple, keeping it as simple as possible, I guess, is what I would say.
Okay, and then so your HR director, your HR team, where do they go to get their training? Like, how do you keep them up to speed?
Chair Taylor, that's a good question. I don't know the exact information on where they get that training. I'd be happy to get that question answered for you later.
Yeah, but it's obviously they're able to manage all these changes that have occurred. They are able to do that.
Yes, yes. Okay. But then again, we do have a department of people, right?
Right. Oh, yeah,
because
of course.
As a middle-sized employer, we do have those resources available to us. So we really think about, for small businesses that don't necessarily have those resources, we need to really think about how it's going to impact them and make sure that we make it as simple as possible for the folks that don't have that level of expertise that companies that are fortunate like us have.
Okay. And then lastly, and I don't know if you can share the specifics, do you have any data that you could share with us for new seasons where people have had to leave their job because they needed to take care of someone who is ill, or they had a child and mm-hmm. you know, it just didn't work out to stay with you as an employer? I mean, do you have any
I don't have specific data. As I said, we've always tried to be very generous around leaves.
Yeah, right.
So even mm-hmm. Even if they're not in a position of having protected leave, if they don't have that eligibility yet, we're more than willing to give people up to 12 weeks of, you know, even before they're ready for protected leave. Mm-hmm. If that's something that they need, we generally keep people on their benefits, trying to hang on to them as long as we can. I'm sure there's probably anecdotally some information around, or stories around, people that have not felt that they could afford to come back to work, mm-hmm. but I don't have any specific data.
No, that's okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. You're just so knowledgeable. I thought I'd go ahead and ask. But I know that you're a great employer, and I was just curious about some of those things. So thank you. Does anybody have any other questions? Yes, Senator Hanson.
I just have a question to the chair. What bill are we talking about?
Well, is it 1070? Is that correct? The paid family medical leave bill. I think it was the bill number from last session. Mm-hmm.
1087?
3087. Sorry, so many bill numbers. So that was the bill that was, we had it and we discussed it briefly in the 17th session.
Mm-hmm.
And then it did not go forward, obviously, but not to say that we would take that exact bill in the future, but I believe that everyone here is. Our panel here has looked at it, mm-hmm. so I was making a reference to that. So the other thing, so thank you, all of you, appreciate that coming up. Also, Teresa Van Winkle, who testified during our last legislative days, who's the executive director of DCBS, or no, she's the, not the executive director, she's the legislative director, excuse me. We asked her a bunch of questions, and then she provided answers, and they are on OLIS. So if anybody wants to look at those, they are there. And then also other people have provided written testimony on this subject, and it's also on OLIS. So, and then lastly, I just want to draw everyone's attention again to this background brief that Deborah prepared for us on family medical leave. This is
very well done, and it really answers a lot of questions, and people have had concerns about the technical aspect of the bill, and I think this really will help us lay the foundation to get those questions answered. So I just wanted to bring this to everyone's attention. So if there aren't any other questions, we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting on paid family medical leave, and we're going to open an informational meeting to provide an overview of Senate Workforce Committee bills for 2018. The Senate Workforce Committee plans to introduce a bill to improve the training provided to home care workers to ensure consistent and professional standards. Melissa Unger, who's the political director for Services Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 503, will provide more information on that. So, I know, everyone's you come oh. up, and I mean, what really.
Not that exciting. But.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
That might be good.
We are going to listen to you. I just want you to know that.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. And I was asked to give an overview of a bill we've been working on, provide training for home care workers. I did include with my testimony two recent reports that I'm going to refer to. First, a Secretary of State audit that was just released a couple of weeks ago that really highlights the need for the bill, although we were already working on it before the Secretary of State audit, and a report that came out from the Thomas P. Miller around workforce development for home care workers, which when that report came out last June, we started working on this bill with stakeholders. So I included those. You know, they're only like 50 to 70 pages, so get a good read while I read this really lengthy testimony. I'm joking. So I think most of you know that SEIU Local 503 represents over 30,000 caregivers in the state of Oregon. We represent home care workers and personal support workers, nursing home workers, and adult foster care providers. Our bill for 2018 really focuses on training for home care and personal support workers. These workers care for consumers that receive long-term care in their homes. Oregon is a leader in long-term care. We rank fourth overall in the AARP study of long-term services and support scorecard that they release annually. But there are underlying rankings, such as our ranking of 27th on quality of life and quality of care, that we really feel like we need to improve on. And we're hoping that this the proposed bill around training can take one step in the direction on improving on that. For the past 5 years, SEIU has been working on ways to make sure that consumers who receive services through the Home Care Commission are ensured quality care, and that home care workers have the ability to provide that quality care. We started to notice that the Home Care Commission was not meeting some of these goals. The program has had to shift quickly because of one of federal regulations and also bringing in the personal support workers who care for individuals with developmental disabilities into the Home Care Commission. Because of these shifts, supports for workers was impacted, and I think many of you have maybe been reached out to by workers over the time about difficulty being paid or accessing training or getting timely background checks. I often get some of those referred back to us to try to help those workers solve those problems through the Home Care Commission. In 2015, we introduced a bill, Senate Bill 775, that directed the Home Care Commission to start looking at how we certify home care workers, reduce bureaucracy by making sure they get one universal provider number instead of having to have multiple provider numbers depending on who their consumers are, and how we can increase workforce development for these workers. That bill that was passed then set up the report that I forwarded you today around from the Thomas P. Miller that really looked about how do we create a comprehensive workforce program. And I do want to say that we've worked closely with the Home Care Commission and the Department of Human Services throughout this report to really start to figure out where we go from where we're at. It was really after this report that we started to work with stakeholders to bring a bill forward for the 2018 session. Over the years, we've started to try to find ways to increase worker training. So we make sure that workers get paid to go to training. We give them an enhanced wage if they go to certain trainings and they get a level of training. We try to make sure that on the registry, if you have trainings, you get moved up the registry. But none of these things have succeeded in making sure a significant numbers of workers have training. You'll notice in these two reports that there's examples of how without adequate training, we really feel like consumers are not getting the quality of care that they need to make sure that the program is working to the point of what it was working for, which is that consumers have quality care in their homes. So when we started working on this bill, the Secretary of State's office recently came out with an audit And we really feel like this bill that will mandate training for home care workers really covers three of the recommendations in the Secretary of State audit. The three are in coordination with the Oregon Home Care Commission and SEIU, establish minimum home care worker training requirements and develop refresher courses for topics covered in orientation. That was one of the direct recommendations. In coordination with the Oregon Home Care Commission and SEIU, implement a new model for managing the home care worker program that lessens the workload of APD staff in the CEP program, which is this program, and establish a skills assessment of home care workers to assure that the skills and knowledge and abilities they have to provide consumer care. Those are the three recommendations this bill really deals with. We've been working with many different stakeholders from Disability Rights Oregon, the Alzheimer's Association, AARP, DHS, the area agencies on aging to really help develop the legislation. The goal of the bill is to set mandatory training and relieve some of the pressure put on case managers to provide training and answer questions by better onboarding workers at the beginning before they start working with consumers. The bill will really create the outline for the program so that the agency and stakeholders can really develop the training program. This is a lot of workers who currently do this. Over 30,000 home care workers provide this work, which is, you know, one of the biggest employer groups in the state, and oftentimes in rural areas are the biggest employer in the state. And so figuring out how we both bring new workers into training but then also train the current workforce will take time, and make sure, just as we heard in previous presentations, I think, create a system where we can do that so that workers and consumers don't have interrupted care. We are currently working with the agency to better understand what money is currently available to be used for training and how we can get a better federal match for those dollars. Training dollars can often be matched 50%. Many of the training dollars we currently have are not being matched. And so we're currently trying to understand which pots of money are being matched and which pots of money are not being matched to help pay for this program. And we're also looking at what other states are doing. In the audit, there was an example of how other states administer this program to look at, and we're trying to figure out what other states are doing to provide the training and services that we currently don't provide. Luckily, we're trying to do this all in time to make sure we have all those answers, those questions answered before session even starts. We're a national leader in making sure that people have the ability to live with independence and dignity in their homes, and we need to continue that work and also work to enhance the program to ensure that it can meet the needs of consumers who want to be able to live comfortably in their own homes. So that is the quick overview of the legislation. It just got put into LC just this last week, I think, and we hope to have a draft here relatively quickly. I can take any questions.
Thank you. And I know I asked you to come to present at the very towards the end there. So, I mean, just this last week or so. So I appreciate you.
No problem.
Doing that. It was a great summary. Any questions? Senator Hansel.
I may have, it's probably in the bill, and I may have missed it, or if you said it, but where will the training program be housed? Who will do it?
Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor, and Senator Hansel. The bill really outlines that the Home Care Commission under the Constitution has a responsibility to train workers. And so the question is how they set it up, whether they'll do an RFP to see if there's someone who can help provide that training. That has yet to be decided, and I think the bill won't dictate that piece because it will go through the rulemaking process that has been done when training mandates have been set for these workers.
Follow up?
Yes.
I think you answered it partly with the different buckets and the match and stuff, but a little more information on how the training will be funded.
Yeah, Senator Taylor and Chair Taylor and Senator Hansel, we're still trying to figure that piece out. So right now there are multiple different buckets of funding that goes to training that we know. Lots of it's being used, but not all of it's being used. So we're trying to figure out exactly where that's at, and then if that all can get matched at the 50% federal match or not. I think that is a big question that we need to come back and have answered for session that we're still trying to figure out. But we're hoping that through the federal match programs and the way that it works, that there's ways to make sure that we can mitigate the costs. We know that that is an important issue, both in this session, but long term for this program too.
All right, so we'll go ahead and thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the informational meeting on the Senate Workforce Committee bills for 2018. And we are done. So we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. And anything else we need to know before we stop here, Deborah? We'll be back here in January, correct?
Yes.
February. January. We have Ledge Days in January. Yeah. Yes. All right. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting, Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Thank you. The meeting, Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Thank you.